Hello everyone, welcome to the Book Fringe. We're extremely excited to have today's guest with us. Danny Dorling is a professor of geography at University of Oxford. He's written numerous books. His latest one, Peak Inequality, is about, as he puts it, the ticking time bomb of economic inequality in Britain, and also chronicles how Britain came to be the most unequal country in Europe. Through looking at housing, health, politics and education, Danny traces the negative impact of economic inequality in all these areas of our lives. But it's not all doom and gloom. There are cracks of light, and Danny, as well as showing how a more equitable society could benefit us all, also points in some ways in that direction. With the support of Danny and the publishers, we're able to offer Peak Inequality Day at just £10. It's normally £12.99, so there's only incentive for you there. And if you're very nice to him, Danny might sign some books for you later on. But please, for the moment, to tell us more about this, please join me in welcoming Danny Dorling.
The volume, okay. So it doesn't do that wee sound.
The volume's about to be tweaked. How are you doing at the back overhearing me? Yeah, all okay. Great. Okay, I'm only going to speak for 25 minutes. I'm just going to basically tell you what's in the book if you decide not to buy it, so you've learned something about it. It is a more optimistic book than most of the books that I've done. And the reason it's optimistic is that it's called Peak Inequality. It's about suggesting that it may well be the case that we actually have got to a high point, and that things, in terms of the gap between us, aren't going to get worse and worse and worse, as they have done for the last 40 years almost. There are lots of downsides as well, but you know, we should remember that if that is true, then that's a good thing. I'm a nerd, so I can't help but look at statistics, be obsessed by them, notice what isn't reported about them. A story that came out last week was that the pay of the bosses, the top CEOs in the country, had gone up again in the last year, I think maybe by 20% or something. And the ratio is something like 453-1. And I've got these wrong, but you know, the average CEO is getting 453 times the average worker in Britain, and this is terrible. Hidden in the bottom of that release from the High Pay Centre was that this ratio is actually less than it was 2 years ago. 2 years ago was the peak for bosses' pay in Britain. It fell quite sharply the year after. Nobody reported that. It was reported as they're still paid too much, which is great, because that's what you need. But this was the first fall we had seen, I think, in 40 years in CEO pay. And the little rise that we've had in the last 12 months is actually a smaller rise that doesn't get you back up to where they were before. And it's a rise that they're doing before they have to report all their pay ratios, which the Conservative government, is making them do. As I've got you trapped, I'll briefly tell you the kind of boring statistical story of income inequality. It was highest in this country around about 1913. It might have been higher in the 1870s, it's hard to measure. 1913 was the last peak. It came down after 1913, partly because of the cost of the First World War, partly because of agitation, partly because of fear of revolution, because you saw a revolution actually work, and if you're rich and you see a revolution work, it kind of makes you, it concentrates the mind. So more terrible what might happen. Inequality fell and fell and fell, fits and starts from 1913 all the way through to around about 1977, 78. And from then onwards, it rose. That's our pattern. Inequality always rises and falls, and it always falls by about as much as it rises. That's one big claim that often isn't made. Thomas Piketty has done lots of very useful things, but Thomas Piketty, if you know him, has done one, I think, large injustice, which is to say inequality was always high, and then we had this brief moment of greater equality, and now we're back to ever-growing inequality unless we do something dramatic at the world level about it. Thomas Piketty is an economist, he's not a geographer, he's not an historian, He only likes data that's really, really good quality, and you can only get really good quality data for that short period where we have the fall and then the rise. But other data of lower quality shows that the 13 colonies in the United States were incredibly equal, if you were white at least, for many, many decades. You can go around the world and see periods of equality, great inequality, something goes wrong. It always goes wrong when you have great inequality, by the way, which is one reason why inequality doesn't sustain. Equality rises again, people forget what it is that they've won, get a bit complacent, the greedy are allowed to get greedy again and they take more. This is a universal pattern. At the moment in the world, the majority of OECD countries, of affluent countries, have for 2 or 3 years seen inequality falling, income inequality falling. It doesn't get reported because you don't report good news, you report bad news. The most unequal countries in the rich world are Singapore, which is really a city, Israel, the United States, and us. We're weird. We are the three really weird countries. The United States inequality is still rising. It's very high and still rising. We appear to be teetering at a peak. Other countries are much, much more equal than us. The Netherlands, the best off 1% in the Netherlands are taking about 6% of all income. That's six times average income. That's about £150,000 a year here. That's the kind of equality we had in the 1970s. And it's not very far away. Switzerland, the top 1% take half what they take here. And that's a fairly conservative banking society. Japan is much more equal. They're worried about a slight increase in inequality, which to them appears to be a big increase, but honestly, we could only dream of having the problems that the Japanese have over their slight increase in inequality. What happened here was that around about 1990, inequality peaked for the bottom 80% of society. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, in his budget speech last year, said that inequality has been falling for years and years and years, and why are we worrying about it? But the measure he was reporting is a measure that ignores the top 10% of society. So 1990 was the peak of inequality for most people. But the top 10% carried on taking more all the way through the 90s. When Tony Blair got into power, you can't see a change in the graph. It was as if he was never elected in 1997. The 1% took more after Tony Blair than they took before Tony Blair. And it wasn't that Tony Blair, I think, wanted the 1% to be even richer after he was elected. He and the people around him just didn't realise how much effort it takes to turn the tide, or that it matters that much. I mean, you'll remember them saying, you know, I don't care what the rich earn as long as they pay their taxes. Turns out it does matter what the rich earn, even if they did pay their taxes, and they're not very good at paying their taxes. The more they get, the less they pay their taxes. The incentive not to pay taxes is very high if you're very rich. The top 1%, their peak of income was around about 2015, 2014, where they're taking about 15%, a sixth of all income. And then they began to see incomes fall for the bottom half of the top 1%. Nobody sheds a tear over the 1%, but you know, it fell. But if you're in the top half of the 1%, they carried on rising. The European Banking Authority released figures on how many bankers in Europe are paid over €1 million a year, every year. Almost all the bankers in Europe paid over €1 million a year are in London, something like 2,200 of them. There's 197 in Germany, 2,200 in London. Their pay peaked about 2016. So you begin to, you're seeing how we're getting there. But the pay of the people above, there were people paid more than bankers who are paid €1 million a year, was still going up. And it wasn't until spring this year when the highest paid boss lost his job. Martin Sorrell, head of WPP, was required to leave. I always wonder which way I can sort of say it. He's the poster boy of peak inequality. The day of his removal from office is for me the peak in Britain. Now, it may not carry on. The problem with calling something the peak is that we can't see the future. So it's not that we're climbing up a mountain and you can look down and see that you're down. You're climbing up a mountain and ahead of you is fog. And it's got a bit flat and it feels very cold and you think you're at the top. But what you're looking at is fog. And you're hoping that you're going down. The fear is that you could go up. It's not impossible for inequality to actually rise again in Britain. That's what Brexit is about. Brexit is a desperate attempt, for my mind, by a set of people who really, really want and desperately believe that this country is special, needs to be great again, is the best country on earth, has only been held back by people like you, most of you, and your stupid ideas of, you know, being kind and equal to people. Held back by trade unionists, held back by socialists, held back by feminists, and then held back by Europeans. And once we were unshackled from that, Britain can become richer and richer and richer. And part of that getting rich will be more billionaires and not worrying about the poor. As long as they're not starving, it's fine. That, to me, is what the Brexit plan is. So there are people who want inequality to rise. They think it's good. They think it rewards talent. It's a measure of how free a country is. I don't think they're going to win. I don't think people are so stupid that you're going to let a small bunch of people, most of whom were brought up in a colony, these are white colonialists who funded the Brexit attempt, to get what they want. But they really want it. You shouldn't underestimate how much they want this. The depressing bit, loads and loads of things go wrong as you approach peak inequality. Your elite are the most out of touch they have ever been. This is the case wherever you look around the world at the time of a peak of inequality. They're automatically out of touch. You're not living the same kind of lives. And they make mistakes, and they make big mistakes. In health in this country, we now have one of the lowest life expectancies in Europe. There are 20 countries where women live longer in Europe. In 1990, we had the 7th best neonatal mortality rate in Europe. By 2015, I think we were down to 17th. And since 2015, the infant mortality rate has risen twice significantly. Infant mortality rate has not risen anywhere else in Europe. This is literally absolutely more dead babies and more grieving parents. These are things that the last time infant mortality rose 2 years in a row in the UK was during the Second World War. That's the kind of circumstances you normally need for it. Overall life expectancy is now falling. 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, the Office of National Statistics, bless them, who were fighting a brilliant rearguard action, released a report that showed that UK life expectancy peaked in 2014 and has been lower ever since 2014. The last time life expectancy fell, apart from during war, you're really going back to the flu was during the war. You go back to cholera years. I mean, it is just unprecedented for this kind of thing to happen. Then there's lots of time for questions if you want to ask about why is it happening. But the important thing is it is happening. The ONS report compared 20 countries, and the UK and the United States were the worst of those 20 affluent countries. The place doing the best, by the way, is Finland. Finland is incredibly annoying. Finland is the country with the biggest increase in life expectancy of all 20 in the last 6 years. Finland has the best education results in the entire world. Finland doesn't measure its teachers. It just lets them have freedom and they do well. Finland is the only place in Europe where homelessness is falling. And Finland has a policy that you house somebody first and worry about their drug addiction after. And so you can go on and on about Finland. Finland is a remarkably weird country and somewhere has to be best, and it's Finland. And similarly, we're the kind of opposite. Somebody has to be the economically most unequal country in Europe. We have the highest Gini inequality measure for income. of all European countries. Occasionally Estonia beat us 1 year, and occasionally Latvia, and occasionally Lithuania, but never for more than 1 year. Otherwise, we're up there. We are extreme. You probably know most of this. Other things that go wrong, education. And things go terribly wrong at the peak. I mean, unbelievably wrong. So suddenly having £9,000 a year fees, you know, it's as if somebody sat down and said, how can we help prove these hippie liberals' theories that everything goes wrong at the peak? I know. We'll suddenly go from £3,000 a year to £9,000 a year fees, you know, just to help really muck everything up and have a system that's completely unsustainable. Academy schools. Yeah, the privatisation of schools. I live in Oxfordshire. Every single comprehensive is an academy in Oxfordshire. Academy schools are essentially set up to encourage corruption and fraud. And we're getting huge amounts of corruption and fraud. You have 8 trustees running an academy school. The trustees are the great and the good. They don't send their own children. You know, their own children go off to the private school. But, you know, but they care about little people. And that's the school my children go to. There are trustees who, and you can look them up because you can see their names. Then you can search them in Companies House and you can see what companies they run. And they run companies which are registered, no employees, just him and her. And whenever you see somebody with a him and her company and no employees, you're half the time looking at a tax dodge. That's who are running academy schools. We can go on and on about education, but it is truly unbelievable. But you get used to it. So you just think, oh, this is normal, it's okay to do this. Obviously, a lot of this is in England. Right? Scotland has protected itself to an extent and tried to protect its universities, it's protected its schools. Wales as well doesn't have academies. And Wales has hardly any private schools. I haven't even talked about private schools yet. I won't do that unless you want me to. But Scotland has been just as affected by the death rate of elderly people. Even having, you know, slight tax varying powers doesn't save you from that. Scotland possibly has moved apart from England with infant mortality, and that needs to be looked at and done better. So if I was going to guess what the biggest achievement of the Scottish Government might be, it might be infant mortality. It's too close to call at the moment. A bit like the best achievement of New Labour was getting one more poor child from a class, one out of 30 to university. That was New Labour's great achievement, one kid in 30. And it was an achievement. So you see these kind of things happening. But then health and education, housing. The most expensive, lowest quality housing in Europe, the smallest rooms, the most dodgy mortgages, ones that vary. You know, on the mainland, you get a mortgage, it's fixed for 20 years at 2%. Private rental doubling in 10 years. And the speed of increase in private rental is now so fast that it's kind of overtaking aging of the population. Your chances of ever getting out of having a private landlord are decreasing faster than you age. I can't quite get the maths of this right, but I remember when we saw this and it was unbelievably quick. One in four of all families in England with children now have a private landlord. Hardly any 15 years ago did. And of course, you know, one problem about talking in a bookshop like this is you know why that's bad. You know why having to move when the landlord decides to give you 2 months' notice and your children have to lose all their friends and go to another school is not necessarily good for kids. And it partly wasn't the plan. The plan to increase private renting wasn't to force families with kids into them. But it turns out that's where the big rise has been. And we can go through and through and through, and it all sounds very, very terrible. So in my remaining kind of 4 minutes, what are the signs for solution? Things are always bad at the peak. They have to be bad at the peak. The kind of things that happen are unprecedented when you hit a peak. So, politically, remember I told you the last time we had a peak was 1913. The last time that the third largest parliament in Westminster was the Nationalist Party was 1918. The third largest party in 1918 was Sinn Féin. Right? It's unprecedented for the third largest party to be nationalist, except as you approach peak inequality. And of course, the third largest party in Westminster are those, whatever, 50 odd or maybe slightly fewer nationalist MPs from Scotland. Corbyn, I'm sure we'll talk about Corbyn later. I like Corbyn, by the way, just in case you were wondering. Corbyn and the 600,000 members and winning two leadership contests and, oh, the biggest swing in voting in June 2017 that we have ever measured in the history of Britain, by the way. Yeah, that might just be related to peak inequality. People are pissed off. They're willing to do things differently than they've done before. In May and June of last year, we saw the fastest change in the polls and in people's willingness to vote in different ways than we have ever measured. Theresa May was completely correct to call the election. Never in the history of Britain had anybody in the situation she was in lost. She had to be forced to do it because she's so timid, but her advisers were completely right to tell her to call the election. And then what happened really was should have been a shock to anybody. It was only 4 or 5 days before the election to actually look possible. And even then, you thought it wasn't possible. The establishment are worried. The establishment don't know what's going to happen. The establishment are fearful. They want to try to hold on to what they've got. Hence all the attacks that you're currently getting on Labour, and you'll get on the Nationalists if it ever looks like a coalition government in Westminster is likely. And finally, to sort of wrap this thing up, Brexit. Now, if you look at voting around the world and you think about the most unequal countries and how they behave, the United States has reached a peak of inequality above anywhere else, and people in the United States behaved in a way that wasn't expected. I was at this festival 3 years ago when people were joking that Trump might become a candidate. The joke was he might become a candidate. Not that he'd win, but that he might become a candidate. The Economist did, I think, the best analysis of the votes for Trump that I've seen, and the swing towards Trump was highest in those counties in the United States which have seen the biggest fall in their health. It's not amongst people who've seen a fall in their health, it's white men who are doing okay. But it's white men doing okay in parts of the US that are falling apart. And it's seeing things fall apart around you. The Brexit vote, when we look at the correlates of the Brexit vote, it's areas where things are falling apart. It's not poor areas. I wish I brought the list for you, but I can give you a list, I think, of 25 areas in the north where fewer people voted to leave than Essex. There are more leave voters in Essex than 25 areas. And I can do the same for Hampshire and Kent, and basically that's it. The leave vote was a majority southern vote, a majority middle class vote, a majority Tory vote, with a lot of UKIP, of course. But it was in parts of the south. This Middlesbrough and Stoke just don't matter. The Leave vote was in parts of the south which are not the winning areas. Not Oxford, not Cambridge, not London. Boring little market towns in between, where your children cannot get a mortgage, where you can see no future even if you've done everything correctly. Where on the high street there are tattoo parlours and Poundland and charity shops. And this is Winchester. You know, it's not, these aren't, and that's where voted for Leave. The UK being the most economically unequal country in Europe and being the first since Greenland to leave, you know, is not, I think, surprising. When Greenland left, Greenland had more reason to leave, they negotiated for 3 years, not two, because they had 56,000 people and it mattered. But the other reason that Greenland negotiated for 3 years is they had something to negotiate about, which was fish. They actually had something to bargain over. And the really interesting thing that we're going to find out this summer and autumn is that we don't have fish. And there's a game being played in the mainland of Europe at the moment of try not to be the first person on the mainland to let the British know that you pity them. And hence, people are trying to do very straight faces about the situation we're in. The next country which was supposed to do a kind of Trump or Brexit was the Front National in France. And what did they do? People got together and voted to stop it. You might not like who they voted in, but they didn't vote in the Front National. And you can look all around the rich world, and you can find in countries that are not Israel, UK and USA, people behaving in far more sensible ways. It's particularly problematic. But to leave you with one kind of optimistic thing, whenever there is a peak of inequality, it almost never turns just because good people get together and agree that they want it to get together, sadly. The Netherlands is the nearest we've come to this, of parents in the 70s who got angry that their kids were being killed on bikes. But even then, the Netherlands had had kind of a long time to learn that it wasn't the most powerful country in the world when the United Provinces were. There's almost always an event that helps kick off. And of course, the First World War was our big event. And we got the First World War partly because our elite was so stupid, they thought it would last a few weeks. If you're trying to pick the kind of event you might want, then of all the possible events that there are, I think Brexit is about the softest possible disaster you can go for that could be what helps sustain what already looks like a fall in inequality. House prices have been falling in London since August 2016. They don't report it because they own the houses, they don't want to say. But since August 2016, and that's not even taking into account the fall in the pound. People are stockpiling food now, probably don't need to, we're quite good at queuing, but we'll find out. They're stockpiling medicines in certain areas and practices. Car plants are quietly being moved, or planned to be moved. Young bankers without families are being sent to Frankfurt and Paris and Canary Wharf. You can see it. Dublin's thriving. Why is Dublin thriving? You know, what's special about Dublin? Where else in the mainland of Europe, well, not the mainland, an island, can you speak English? It's the only place. But to my mind, the silver lining of Brexit, however it happens, or even doesn't happen, it's still entirely possible for May to send a letter rescinding it. It's entirely up to her. But even if she does that, imagine the national humiliation of May walking into Parliament and saying, I sent a letter last night. Can you think of anything? I mean, it beats Suez, doesn't it? In terms of a moment of greatest national humiliation, I'll leave you with that as an idea, something can come up with. And that'd be my preference. My preference is that May sends a letter. But even then, where does that leave the English elite as a body? And ultimately, you need to change the elite. Things get better when the elite are changed. The most dramatic way to become more equal, the most effective way, is to lose a war. When Germany lost a war, when Japan lost a war, that's why they became so equal. It's partly the behaviour of the invading force, it's partly because the people with all the power and the money lose all their power and the money. But wars are not good. We shouldn't be aiming for wars, let alone trying to lose one. And also, we shouldn't cut ourselves up too much about how we have ended up like this. Part of the reason we're so bad is because we haven't lost a war for a long time. We've had the same elite in charge for a long time. But also, we had the world's biggest empire the world had ever known. The reason why Scotland and England really came together and stayed together was that the cash you could get from the rest of the world was just too good to miss. And if you have had the biggest empire the world has ever known, and you've had the same elite and their families in charge since then, that, I think, goes a long way to explaining why you end up in such a mess now. And I don't think we should beat ourselves up about it too much and say, you know, why didn't we do a better job in the 70s to stop this happening? The question is, can we do what they did in the Netherlands, having been given longer now? Can we make sure that this thing reduces and reduces and reduces? It takes 20 or 30 years before you even begin to feel the benefit. That's the bad news. But can we get, like other countries in the rest of the world, and not go back up to this again? That should be the aim. Thank you for letting me waffle on. Please think of a question for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. So we've just got a very little bit of time for questions. So if anybody's gotten, stick your hands up and just please keep them succinct, and we'll take two at a time. So yes, please.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. You talked about peak income inequality. Can you tell us a bit about where we are with wealth inequality?
Same question.
All right.
Back there. Yeah. I was interested to know whether you've actually got any views on how carers of people with disabilities are actually affected by inequality, particularly in terms of access to leisure, being isolated, absolute poverty itself, not being able to get food.
Okay. Wealth inequality tends to lag income inequality, so it carries on rising even after income inequality begins to fall, because just having money. I was out drinking with a doctor last night who told me that some of his doctor friends have discovered that if they just give their spare cash, because they have spare cash, because they're paid a lot, to, is it Belford Gifford? Bailey Gifford. They said, if you give the cash to Bailey Gifford, they give you back far more the year later, and you don't have to do anything. So, wealth inequality lags. The more interesting thing about wealth inequality is that quite a lot of the most equal countries, Norway, Finland, Denmark, have very high wealth inequality, but it doesn't appear to matter. And the reason it doesn't matter is you don't let the wealthy use their money. You're fairly good at this. You could get better in Scotland, but I mean, I live in Oxford. One of the nearest country pubs to me is called Cornbury. And I was in Cornbury last weekend, and I had a daughter on crutches, and I wanted to take a shortcut. And the man said, you can't go that way. And I said, you work here. And he said, no, I own it. And so we had to pretend we weren't going to trespass, and then of course we trespassed, it's not stupid. But we need, I don't mind him still owning Cornbury. I want him to build 20 footpaths over within the cycle lane and make sure they're safe. So with wealth, don't worry too much about wealth. You just control what the wealthy are allowed to do, and then the wealth doesn't matter so much. I haven't got a good answer about carers, I'm afraid, other than one of the arguments against us being at peak inequality is the situation of both carers and the people that they're caring for, which is still deteriorating. So that isn't one of the strongest arguments that I've got it wrong is this deterioration. And if the government carry on being as nasty as they're being, then we won't be at the peak.
Thanks. Can we take another two together? Right at the back there.
Just a quick question. It's partly about the point you made about Brexit being perhaps the softest catastrophe you might be facing, but I wonder whether that's partly premised on a future Labour government, because obviously one of the big elephants in the room is the country's future relationship with the US, and that can go in a number of directions, I suppose, but my concern would be obviously that could go in a very pernicious direction, so I'm just wondering whether you can comment on that.
And just here.
Oh, hi, Carol Cameron. How do we solve the housing crisis? Just a small one.
Small one.
Okay. Tiny.
Okay, Brexit first because it's easier in a way. This is what they want. Alistair Campbell did a blog this week, and it's worth looking at, and I don't read much of that Alistair Campbell does, but just look at his blog, and his blog is about he read the book written by Jacob Rees-Mogg's father. And Jacob Rees-Mogg's father, the last book he wrote, The End of the Times, is all about the future that they desire, which is strong ties with the US and let the billionaires in. So there are a group who are trying to get this, and will be Airstrip 1, and you know, a special relationship, if they can remember who we are. It's just that it only benefits this tiny fraction of a percent of people. It only benefits them because they really don't care about, and they may not be able to care, I suspect. You know, I'm a geographer, so I can't tell, but I think we need psychiatrists to go in and actually check. And then we could understand. I don't think they want, I don't think they understand the misery that they cause. But it's a possibility. It's a bit like the most unequal country in around about 1931 in Europe was Germany. And the inequality rose and rose. And there's great dangers of what can happen when you're very unequal. So that it is entirely possible. And you've got to understand, Jonathan Haidt has done brilliant books on the psychology of Republicans. You've got to understand why there are a group of people who think Boris is brilliant. And if you can't see what there is to like about Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg, then you won't understand the danger. And it's getting into their heads and realising the like for authority, the dislike of dirtiness and these other things. Housing. We have enough housing almost everywhere. We have enough housing. We haven't been building too many new houses or flats. We've actually been adding bedrooms. So we have more bedrooms per person than ever. We even have more bedrooms than people just in flats and houses, let alone hotels and the rest in London. Everybody could be housed in London in their own bedroom, not share a bed with anybody. It's all there. So you simply have to work out. I mean, we do need some building. Oxford is the one place I would say that a little bit of building would help. But almost everywhere else, you need to reduce inefficiencies. The most inefficient part of housing is the private rental market. I mean, people who love the market, the most efficient is social housing. Social housing is allocated by need. They put you into something that just fits you and your kids with no spare space. That's what you get. Private rental market, somebody's in a maisonette, it's a council maisonette, there's him and her, there's two kids, they fit in the house maisonette, it's nice. Loads of people around you in the maisonette, there's a bit of grass outside, the sign says no ball games, the kids play football on the grass. That was the 1970s, it was brilliant. Then they bring in right to buy, you buy your council maisonette, you think you've done well, then you sell your council maisonette to a landlord, that landlord then rents it out to whoever will pay the most. The person who pays the most is the young professional in London, and suddenly you've got one person in that maisonette rather than four. And the young professional in London is really annoyed that they have to rent what they see as a grotty council maisonette. Well, it's tragic. And this was a home that people were really happy to have before. I mean, it's sometimes, and this is part of the reason why I wish I knew more about psychology. Some of this is so obvious, you have to think, well, why don't people get it? And they don't get it because they believe in difference, and they believe in desert and deserving things. And they believe some people deserve entire mansions and castles. And they design housing, so they make it smaller and smaller and smaller for the undeserving, because they've got this really deep sense of their kind of justice. And it's very different. I mean, hopefully there's one or two far-right people in the room. Come up and talk to me later, please. I'll be nice, honestly. But I think there's a real problem on the left and amongst radicals of not understanding the core beliefs and things that are held deeply by the people you're up against. You know, just look and think you're stupid. But they're not stupid. And if they were stupid, it would be easy.
I'm really sorry we're out of time for questions, but you might be able to ask Danny a quick question around the corner of the signing table. If you could just keep your seats for a minute until we're able to get out and get around there. But please, for the moment, join me in thanking again Danny Dorland.